This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of April 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The Texas legislature's effort to overturn ride-hailing rules embraced by Austin voters.
HB 100 is not about a particular company or any particular city.
Why sleep research supports putting Austin City Council's late meetings to bed.
You're going to decline in cognitive functioning.
And a new poll suggests millennials in Austin are more optimistic about the city's future.
We continue to see the youthification of Austin.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. We have links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. And do leave us a review or a rating in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store if you have an opportunity. It does help us out a lot. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, Nathan@KUT.org is my email address. A panel of federal judges has found Texas lawmakers intentionally diluted the power of minority voters in drawing state legislative maps in 2011. As KUT's Matt Largy reports, this is the second such ruling in recent months.
The three-judge panel in San Antonio found lawmakers illegally used race as a factor in drawing maps, splitting blocks of minority voters into separate districts to reduce their power at the polls. The ruling could affect the boundaries of statehouse seats in some of Texas's most populous areas, including Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio, as well as El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley. It comes after a ruling last month that found similar discrimination in how several of the state's congressional districts were drawn. The judges did not order any immediate changes to either map, so it's not clear how or if the rulings will affect elections in 2018. Matt Largy, KUT News.
Members of the Texas House have been debating a bill that would create statewide regulations for ride-hailing companies such as Fasten or Ride Austin or Uber or Lyft. The bill, if it becomes law, would prohibit fingerprint-based background checks for drivers and void all city regulations related to ride-hailing. This is, of course, a contentious issue in Austin. It's been almost a year since Austin voters rejected an effort funded mostly by Uber and Lyft to overturn a city council ordinance requiring the fingerprint-based background checks. This referendum was in May 2016. And after that ballot proposition failed and the rule requiring the fingerprint checks went into effect, Uber and Lyft shut down their service in the city of Austin. They haven't been back since. The lead author of this bill, State Representative Chris Patty, Republican of Marshall, says it's not about Austin.
Let me first start by clearing up some misconceptions that you may have heard about HB 100. HB 100 is not about a particular company or any particular city. In fact, a statewide regulatory framework for transportation network companies is an issue that I began working on last session and I've been working on for almost 3 years.
He said this bill puts Texas in line with the growing number of states that have statewide regulations, 41 states by his count. But some state reps tried to amend the bill with pieces of ordinances such as fingerprinting that are already the rules in the state's largest cities, setting up exchanges such as this one between Austin State Rep Eddie Rodriguez and Dallas lawmaker Yvonne Davis, both Democrats.
Drivers who had already been cleared by background checks by ride-hailing companies, they found almost over 8,200 that would have failed, I guess, a fingerprint.
So basically, they slipped through.
They slipped through.
But with the fingerprints, you were able to stop 8,200 drivers that should not be driving our citizens.
Exactly right. Thank you.
And so that kind of explains why we need to be able to do background checks. And if we're not going to do it at the state level, we ought not to prohibit cities from doing it in their communities.
But Austin, Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio area reps failed in their attempts to amend the bill to work within their city's ordinances. So this bill, HB 100, passed third reading this week, which means it's going to the Senate. But that was not the only thing the House did this week. KUT senior editor Ben Philpott has been keeping an eye on the legislature for us. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
The House has been taking up several Senate proposals this week that are kind of controversial, right?
Yeah, they've begun kind of the task of moderating some of the Senate proposals. I think, you know, as the session opened up, we had some indications that the House would just simply not take up some of what the Senate viewed as a top priority. School vouchers being one of those bills that the House still seems very unlikely to touch at all. But this week, we not only had a committee hearing on the bathroom bill, the so-called bathroom bill that regulates, well, the Senate version regulates that you can't use a restroom unless it matches the gender on your birth certificate. The House took up a bill. It did do that moderating a little bit within this bill, but it still says that municipalities cannot add any protected class of people, and they cannot dictate who is allowed to use a restroom.
So in Austin, that would overturn the ordinance here saying you can't discriminate against transgender people?
That's right. And same thing with school districts. So Fort Worth ISD famously was one of the dominoes to fall to get Republican leadership upset about this, saying that transgender students would be allowed to use, you know, the restroom that aligned with their gender identity. And that will be, you know, gone because of this bill as well.
What's the next controversial Senate bill that's going to go before the House?
It's, you know, sanctuary cities is up next. Now, this is one that in the last legislative session, the Senate passed a sanctuary cities bill. It didn't make it out of the House. Again, the Senate very early on passed a sanctuary cities bill, sent it to the House. The House had a couple hearings on it went with what some in the Senate would consider a watered down version of the bill. The biggest difference is that the Senate version said if you are not in 100% compliance with immigration law, federal immigration law, the state could pull back some grants that it allows different counties and cities to apply for. The House version doesn't have that in there. The House version doesn't talk about the money, but what both of the versions do is they do criminalize a sheriff for not
honoring warrantless detainer requests from federal immigration authorities.
Right. It would make it a high misdemeanor, which would be enough to then trigger another section of Texas code, which says if you're charged with this, you cannot hold public office.
All right, Ben, anything else to keep our eye on next week?
Well, budget. We've got conference committees now from both the House and Senate. They're going to start working on trying to reconcile the differences between the two chambers. That will be maybe about a 2 or 3 or 4 week process. And, you know, we're winding down. We've only got a couple of weeks now before we start hitting some of the deadlines in the House for when you have to stop considering different items in the legislature. So it's getting close.
KUT senior editor Ben Philpott keeping an eye on the state legislature for us. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
The director of the state's liquor regulator is stepping down. Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission Executive Director Sherry Cook's resignation follows reporting by Texas Tribune reporter Jay Root about Cook and her employees attending liquor conferences funded by the alcohol industry. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're reporting that Executive Director Sherry Cook is getting ready to resign. Can you tell us what you found out in your reporting?
Well, what we found out was the agency brass, the very top officials, have been taking quite a lot of trips to places as far away as Hawaii, San Diego, Florida, on these trips that are organized by the National Conference of State Liquor Administrators, which pays for a lot of this stuff like the open bar and a lot of the sort of wining and dining that goes on is paid for by the liquor industry. And that didn't sit well with the legislature. After our first series of reports came out, we also reported on some pretty cozy ties between the agency and the liquor industry, basically through these conferences. And then there was a hearing last week in which an additional topic came up about cars that the top brass are driving, and they really weren't able to account for all of them. That was sort of the last blow, I think.
And then, of course, there was that flyer. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the flyer. The flyer was kind of shocking. That is really what led me into this series of reports to begin with. I was sort of just looking around a little bit at TABC and fell upon some records. Among them was a flyer. It looks like a, sort of a joke thing. Right when you look at it, you see immediately that it's a joke. But it has like a private jet, and in the windows of the jet, you have the director of the agency, the licensing director, and two contractors, and they're like guzzling Lone Star beer, and there's an inscription across the top of it that says, California, here we come, NCSLA 2015, National Conference of State Liquor Administrators 2015, and then woohoo and big with big exclamation points.
Right, and it's kind of like a Photoshop job, right?
Like a Photoshop deal, like a fake flyer, right, advertising a trip. And basically what it was that the agency itself had created this on agency time with input from Sherry Cook, the head of the TABC, and others at the agency, and that did not at all sit well with Representative Sarah Davis, the member of the legislature, the House member who is the chair of the House General Investigating and Ethics Committee. And there was a very bruising hearing last week in which Sarah Davis distributed these flyers to the witness table and then had the people that were in the flyer get up there and testify, you know, why the heck did they do this? And ultimately, Sherry Cook admitted that it was a misuse of state resources.
Sherry Cook's departure from the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, what's going to be the effect of that on the commission itself?
I don't sense a lot of disruption in the alcohol industry, but in terms of the agency riding the ship that's been sort of left listing because of these reports that we reported on of spending and going to these swanky resorts all over the country, that's going to come to an end, I believe.
Is this the first time your reporting has led to the resignation of the head of a state agency?
No.
Or commission? No?
No. No, it's not. But it doesn't happen very often, and it definitely doesn't happen this quickly. I sort of knocked off the head of the lottery commission many years ago, and it actually involved something that went before the House General Investigating and Ethics Committee. That's a very interesting committee, and this is a very interesting committee with some members that Sarah Davis, Giovanni Capriglione, Chris Turner, Hugh Shine, Joe Moody, and then I think there's four Price. I think I've named them all now, but that's a very serious committee. When you get hauled before their committee, you're typically not, you have disturbed someone powerful.
Jay Root is an investigative reporter for the Texas Tribune. He was joining us to talk about Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission Executive Director Sherry Cook's resignation that followed his reporting into the commission. And you can check out those stories at texastribune.org. Jay, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
People in Austin will soon be able to address the city council from a public library. This starts next month. One library in each council district will have video conferencing set up for people to provide remote citizen communication. The only exception is in District 9, which is already home to City Hall. But Austin Mayor Steve Adler says they want to make it easier for people to engage with the city council.
This is a program designed to make government more accessible. And frankly, I think it's going to help us hear from people that we might not be hearing from today.
The Austin City Council spends almost half of its time in its regular meetings listening to members of the public. So in 2016, city staff did an analysis. They found that was 45% of the almost 350 hours of Austin City Council meetings. When people are commenting on specific items, sometimes they have to hang out till the wee hours of the morning for city council to take up the issue when these meetings run long. Other times, of course, people just leave because they also have lives and they can't wait up till 2 a.m. to comment on a vote the council is about to take. So when Austin Mayor Steve Adler took the job in 2015, he promised to do away with these late night meetings. And it hasn't really happened yet. But now council members are considering a rule that would prohibit them from taking up new items after 10 p.m. As KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, sleep researchers are firmly behind the idea.
Early the morning of June 24th, 2016, Councilmember Delia Garza checked her watch.
We're making a decision about $720 million at 1:35 in the morning after lengthy discussions, after, in my opinion, no real agreement on this.
Eventually, council members took the first vote on what would become the city's $720 million transportation bond, approved by voters in November. As members voted, the clock tolled 1:36 a.m. They'd been on the dais for nearly 16 hours.
Is it the end of the world that day?
David Schneer, a psychology and neuroscience professor at UT, asks, why push it?
If you get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and you're staying up, you know, past a typical sleep time, you're going to decline in cognitive functioning.
This means a drop-off in our ability for
decision-making, so being able to hold, say, several ideas in mind at once and then manipulating those ideas and coming up with some kind of answer.
Those who have been awake for too long also have trouble paying attention and a hard time accessing long-term memory. Over the past 2 years, 1 in 5 council meetings ran past midnight. More than 1/3 of meetings ran past 10 p.m. In some cases, city leaders have acknowledged the negative effects of voting that late. Councilmember Ora Houston said she regretted a vote in June she'd taken on the mobility bond. She said she was fatigued and having trouble processing information. Councilmember Greg Kassar also had his issues at that late meeting.
I realize how edgy I was getting by the end of the night.
Common when you've been awake for too long, says Schneer.
You may blow your top more readily at 2 in the morning than you would at, say, 3 in the afternoon.
Late night council meetings are tough.
Carmen Llanos Pulido is the community director for Go Austin, Vamos Austin, known as GAVA. Among other issues, the group supports safer transportation options for people in Southeast Austin, one of the city's largest Hispanic districts. Pulido organizes Dove Springs residents to come and speak to council. As someone who testifies,
the ability to cognitively think about something and vote is certainly one question, but also a human being's ability to listen diminishes not only in the late hours of the night, but after a certain number of hours at any time of day of taking input.
But Pulido says sometimes there's a benefit to keeping odd hours.
I do remember that one of those late nights that we had residents testifying, one of the residents was one of those people who works odd hours and works 2 or 3 jobs at a time and actually was able to stay late and give testimony.
Okay, can you tell me your name and what time it is?
My name is Jared Kinsler, and the time is 12:56 a.m.
Jared's my boyfriend. To be clear, I'm not drunk, even though I sound it.
I was actually asleep.
And had been for 2 hours.
And why are you up this late?
I'm productive at night. I find it, I'm awake and creative at night.
Jared often stays up until 1 or 2 in the morning, reading and writing music. It's been a point of pain in our relationship. I'm a morning person. Like 6:30 a.m., I'm wide awake and ready to go. If he could, he'd sleep until noon. But on this Tuesday night, I asked him to wake me up before he went to bed, so I could read him this.
The city manager is directed to develop recommended proposition language for council consideration by August 11th, 2016. That's in the past. For placement on the November 2016 ballot, requesting authority for the sale of $720 million in general obligation bonds. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Partially.
Genetically, we have figured out that there are morning larks and night owls. So there are some people who perform really well in the middle of the night.
Pat Carter is an associate professor of nursing at UT. She specializes in sleep research. Councilmember Kathy Tovo, for example, hardly looks bothered at these late meetings. She told me she's one of those night owls. But Carter says that's of little help for people who need to be on the dais at 10 a.m. when meetings start.
The problem comes when we start our day at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and then we expect to still be able to function well at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and make those potentially major life-altering decisions for people.
Caffeine, I'm sorry to say, has its limits.
If your decision-making abilities are drained, your tank is empty, coffee's not going to make it any sharper. If that, it's just can only do so much to add. It's an additive effect. So first thing in the morning, yes, it'll make you a little sharper. Your brain is rested. But as you move throughout the day and you just deplete those stores and your abilities, coffee's not going to add anything to it.
Council members have spent hours over the past several weeks talking about how to make their meetings more efficient, including no new items after 10 p.m. Other ideas? Limit public testimony and post items further in advance so council members have time to digest them. Here's my idea. Play them off the dais like at the Oscars.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink.
Wait, before I go. Fun fact for listeners, Mayor Steve Adler does not drink coffee. Do with that what you will. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
I get up and fix myself a drink. No. I'm so tired, I don't know what to do. I'm so tired, my mind is set on.
That's music from Light Wheel, a duo from Austin performing Saturday night at the Mohawk on Red River, one of three local acts on that bill. And there are about a dozen other shows and events on Saturday night in that short cultural district that basically runs along Red River from 6th to 12th Street. But a new study by a nonprofit education and research organization called the Urban Land Institute says that entire stretch of Austin's live music scene along Red River is facing endangerment and could disappear in the coming years. That report is not due out till mid-May. But Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, got his hands on it. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Nathan.
What is this study by the Urban Land Institute?
It's a look at the economic viability and just kind of the situation that the Red River Cultural District, which that stretch is known as, kind of the economic realities facing that area. You've got some tremendous development projects happening nearby with the Waller Creek Conservancy project and the series of parks and the medical school happening just further up the street. And all that is going to increase land values, open up lots more property for development, which it certainly doesn't cause rents to decrease. And so you have music venues that, you know, operate on a pretty short window of the business day and are typically fairly slim in their profit margins, are just increasingly getting pushed toward the margins. It's harder for them to make a go of it.
This report was commissioned by the Red River Cultural District Merchants Association, right? I guess some of the venues in question asked for this examination.
Exactly. In the last year or so, the venues and other entities down in that area have tried to pitch in together and figure out how to save each other's bacon.
So this report has 20 recommendations. What does this report suggest?
Some of them are obvious. Some of them are things like improving the safety and improving the streetscape, just environment there to increase daytime usage. But some of them are also a little bit adventurous, you might say. They advocate the city creating a citywide venue preservation program where you would essentially, in some form or fashion, encourage public-private partnerships to buy up property or venue properties with the explicit purpose of saving them. Other methods include just utilizing a ton of different incentives or tax structured packages to kind of reinvest into that district. And some folks have even mentioned possibly diverting some of the city's hotel occupancy tax revenues toward that district as a whole. Exactly how you could pull that off legally is still to be determined, but people are thinking blue sky, wide open ideas because they realize, as the report says, you know, that district is kind of in its 11th hour. If we don't step in and do something, we could lose the golden goose, which is another term that they use.
Chad, you've been reporting on this issue for a while. We've heard before that the Red River Cultural District is facing challenges from development and rising rents. Was there anything in this report by the Urban Land Institute that surprised you that you hadn't heard before?
I can answer that a couple ways. You know, one is I was kind of shocked by how frank this thing was. I've seen a lot of studies and reports and analyses over the years for efforts like this, and all of them seem to come with a agenda or a goal in mind. This one seemed a little more authentic, just being no holds barred in terms of what the reality of the situation is. So that was surprising. Another thing, you know, what I mentioned earlier about, think about it, a citywide venue preservation program. Like, I'm not against the idea, but holy cow, that's some socialist stuff. In Texas, how are we going to do that? I don't know. But so I like the fact that it was so, like I said, blue sky and not holding back in terms of possible solutions to address this issue.
Chad Switecki is with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, and you can read his story about this at austinmonitor.com. Chad, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Nathan.
Every year, hundreds of volunteers wander the streets of Austin day and night to get an accurate tally of the city's homeless population, as accurate as possible anyway. This is a survey called the Point in Time Count. KUT's Kate Gretzinger reports this year's results show some slight improvement over last year.
Volunteers with Ending Community Homelessness Coalition held this year's count on January 28th. The group counted 2,036 people. Around two-fifths of the people counted were sleeping on the streets. About two-fifths were in shelters, with the rest in transitional housing. And overall, the number of people experiencing homelessness was down by about 100 people this year. Ann Howard is executive director of Ending Community Homelessness.
Certainly the direction we want to go is downward.
Howard says while the drop is only about 5% of the overall population, there is more good news buried in the data.
The number of folks who are experiencing chronic homelessness dropped 28%. From last year. And that is significant. And that does reflect this community working so hard.
While the overall number was down, that wasn't true for downtown Austin. The urban core has the highest number of homeless people and saw an increase this year. Mayor Pro Tem Kathy Tovo represents much of that area.
We are moving in the right direction, but we still have tremendous need. I know, though, as a community, we can come together and make sure that no Austinite has to call a street or a park, their home.
Tovo called on the city and private donors to provide resources for housing, like the city was able to do last year in finding homes for veterans as part of a federal grant program. Howard, with Ending Community Homelessness, says that and other success stories can be attributed to the collaborative efforts of local agencies.
We started coordinated assessment the end of 2014. So I think we're starting to see the benefits of the community working together, acting as one, using a shared data set, and prioritizing the most vulnerable.
Howard says the next step is increasing the city's ability to help people in need. She says there are plenty of people eligible for services and housing, but there aren't open slots available. Kate Gretzinger, KUT News.
Austin is among a handful of U.S. cities that could see a rush of newcomers as sea levels rise, forcing people away from coastal areas. That's according to a new study published in Nature Climate Change Journal. KUT's Mose Bouchel takes a look at the research and what we know about climate migration.
Matt Hauer is a demographer at the University of Georgia. He says when people study sea level rise caused by global warming, they often think about how it will affect cities and people living on the coast.
With sea level rise, we're talking about the conversion of essentially habitable land into uninhabitable water. Then it really begs the question, where are these people likely to go? And so this paper tries to answer that question.
He did it by taking a look where people are moving from and where they're moving to and projecting out, assuming that people affected by sea level rise will probably move to destinations where people are already moving. In Texas, he says, by the end of the century, as sea level rises, more than 250,000 people could move to Houston and another 250,000 to Austin.
Yeah, Austin is semi-close to the coast if you think about it. It's one of the major cities that's not on the coast in Texas but is near the coast. It has a very thriving economy as well. So for Austin to be a destination, it makes a huge amount of sense.
I think his assumption's a reasonable one.
Lloyd Potter is the state demographer of Texas. He says a city's history of attracting newcomers is usually a good indicator of how many will come in the future. But climate change also introduces uncertainties. What if a destination city like Austin gets too dry to support the growth? What if people affected by sea level rise stay closer to the coast?
I mean, it could be they just move 10 miles further inland and now they're still on the coast.
Another question is who might be affected. Steve Murdoch is a sociologist at Rice University and former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. He says Austin's relatively high cost of living might complicate the projections.
The reality is it's the poor who end up getting victimized by natural disasters, and they have to move. They're not going to be able to move to places where the cost of housing is even higher than where they're living now.
The question of who might be displaced is exactly what Hauer, the study's author, wants to look at next. In the meantime, he says coastal communities and destination cities should consider investing in housing and infrastructure to prepare for sea level rise and population shifts. Moz Bushel, KUT News.
Do you think things are headed in the right direction or off on the wrong track? Do you believe Austin is at risk of losing its appeal because of the rising cost of living? Those are some of the first questions asked in a new public opinion survey of people who live in Austin. Peter Zandan has been financing this annual poll for several years. How many years has it been, Peter?
Oh, I started it in the 90s.
Okay, but the poll was conducted by...
Cambia Information Services.
Thanks for joining us today, Peter, to talk about it.
And thank you for having me.
What stands out to you the most out of all of these many questions you asked about Austin?
Well, we continue to see the youthification of Austin. I mean, the best lens to look at Austin is truly your generation. And this is a city for millennials. The millennials love it. I kind of liken it to a marriage where millennials are still very much in their honeymoon period. When you get into your 10, 20, 30 years in Austin, it's a very different relationship. You see people acknowledging the flaws, talking about traffic, talking about affordability, and you can see very different numbers for people who have been here. But if you've only been here for 10 years, you're very much in love with the city.
So how does that reflect in specific findings? I'm going to go back to some of these questions that I asked at the beginning here. Thinking about Austin today, do you think things are headed in the right direction or off on the wrong track? 52% of people in this survey said right direction, 35% said wrong track. And interestingly, both of those were up a bit from 2015.
Right. Let's dig a little deeper into that.
Please.
And look at the millennials. Well, for millennials, 64% say we're on the right track and only 25% say we're not. Whereas if you go over the age of 35, the numbers shift to 44% think we're on the right track. So you see a real divide there.
And when it comes to the most important problems facing Austin today, not a big surprise, I guess, to see traffic and affordability topping the list.
Right. But we have seen a little bit of a shift. People are complaining, believe it or not, a little bit less about traffic. I think it's a given. I've been here in Austin since the 70s. We were complaining about Austin traffic in the 70s. I remember a dear friend of mine was going like, can you imagine I have to stop for stop signs now in Austin? I mean, you could just run them. It was a joy. But people were complaining that there's so many cars, you had to stop. You know, now, obviously, it's on a whole different scale, but we like to complain about traffic.
I guess there's concern that when it comes to the affordability aspect, which was the second highest ranking problem among respondents to the poll, that affordability might be making Austin less appealing. Rising
cost
of living.
Yeah, good point. What we saw is we asked the survey respondents, you know, is Austin likely to lose its appeal because of the rising cost of living? And we saw 88% of the people say, yes, it's a big issue. There was no difference between whether you're young or old. Everyone's recognizing the higher cost of living in Austin. One other point on that, which I think is really fascinating, is over 60% of Austinites have said they've had to change their lifestyle because of the increasing cost. So I guess they're making a trade-off. No one sounds like they're leaving Austin, but they are having to change their lifestyle because of that rising cost.
Let's just do really quickly sort of a rapid-fire thing. I'll ask you the politician, and you tell me how they did it in the poll among Austinites.
I'll try and keep up with you.
All right. Well, let's start with Austin City Council.
City Council, 35% of us have a favorable opinion. 19% unfavorable, 36% neutral.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler.
Our mayor has a little higher, 38% favorability, 17% unfavorable, and 35% neutral.
Governor Greg Abbott.
Our governor has 32% favorable, 39% unfavorable, and 23% neutral.
President Trump.
For our president, favorable ratings are 28%, unfavorables are 54%, and neutral is 16%.
Short-term rentals, you asked about that. What did people say?
Do you oppose restriction on short-term rentals? Yes, I support restrictions is 31%. No, I oppose restrictions, 42%, and 26% were unsure.
Finally, I want to ask you about Uber and Lyft. What was the question on those two ride-hailing companies?
Do you support Uber and Lyft no longer serving the city of Austin? 49% say they do not support it. 26% say they don't care. And 24% say yes, they support the city.
That is just a taste of the Voices of the Austin Community Zandan poll for 2017. Peter Zandan has been financing this poll on a pretty regular basis for more than 20 years now. And he does data analytics for Hill and Knowlton Strategies. Peter, thanks so much for your time.
Yep, thank you.
That is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of April 2017. Thank you so much for listening. Reminder to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And if you have any questions or comments, you can email me, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,